Good morning, everyone. It's nice to see everyone here this morning. I'm particularly thrilled to have my colleagues with me, Judge Sykes and Judge Coffey. And as you know, everything in the Court of Appeals works on seniority. And because they're with me for the first time today, I'm presiding judge. So we are ready to begin the call of the day with case number 034039, Hamden versus Ashcroft. Mr. Block?
Good morning, Your Honors. Mr. Holman, all interested bystanders. My name is Attorney Harold Block, and I'm representing the appellant in this case, Mr. Hussam Hamden. Mr. Hamden is an ethnic Palestinian who was born in Kuwait, and after Saddam Hussein invaded the country, he and his family fled Kuwait with many other Palestinians and went to Jordan, where they were assured that they would be receiving some type of protected status. While in Jordan, Mr. Hamden noticed what he believed were a lot of things that were inequitable, that were going on as far as treatment of Persian Gulf evacuees who were Palestinians.
Excuse me, Mr. Block, yes. I hate to interrupt you, and I do want to hear what you have to say, but I need you to respond to the government's argument that we lack jurisdiction here.
Sure. All right. Well, with respect to the jurisdiction issues, one of the issues that has been raised, of course, by the government is that when it comes to an opinion with an opinion without a decision without opinion by the board, that this is essentially a non-reviewable case. Now, the courts have, of course, many times indicated that if, in fact, the advisory without an opinion or the affirmance without opinion is something that complies with the streamlining rules, that it very well may be that the function of the court would be to look at and determine the content of the immigration judge's decision. It's our position in this particular case that the streamlining rules define the appropriate standards for when this process should be used, and that in this case it doesn't apply.
Well, let me, can you just speak to Section 1252A2B? Because I think it clearly states that no court has jurisdiction to review any judgment granting relief under Section 1255, and that's the relief that you seek here.
You're referring to the adjustment of status.
Right, me. Right. Let's begin.
All right, sure. It is true that the regulations and the law defines adjustment of status as a discretionary remedy that can be accorded to an applicant in the exercise of discretion. But in this case, quite frankly, I think what is replete throughout the record of this case is that in order to arrive at a position to bootstrap the exercise of, quote, discretion that the immigration judge exercised in this case to deny the application, the immigration judge violated numerous tenets of law as far as they relate to maintaining an impartial position with respect to adjudication of the basic questions associated with the adjustment process. For instance, there was a decision that the judge had rendered 2 years earlier in which he denied asylum relief to the applicant, but at the conclusion of that determined that he was credible, determined that he believed that he had been mistreated, although the mistreatment didn't rise to the level of persecution, and that he believed that he felt that there was a subjective component of fear, but that there was no way to objectively show it. He also ruled at that time that the applicant was eligible for voluntary departure. There was no evidence that he was a person of poor moral character, and he granted that as an alternative to deportation. Subsequently, when this case was remanded by the Board of Immigration Appeals, upon motion by me for consideration of adjustment of status, the immigration judge revisited his 1999 opinion two years and some months later, and made a number of findings, if you will, that were completely contrary to the conclusions he made in that hearing. How did he do this? Well, from the very get-go, he engaged in direct examination in a hostile and badgering fashion of the respondent, who he knew was a paranoid schizophrenic, to elicit what he termed inconsistencies in the answers he had given more than 2 years previously. Now, this case had not been
remanded. Well, he has the authority to do that, though, to look back to see what the responses were 2 years before and at the current.
He can look back to see what those responses were. However, in his questioning and then in his conclusions at the end of the hearing, he mischaracterized what the differences in those were. For instance, I believe that in the adjustment application, he concluded that there was no, among other things, that there wasn't mistreatment, although he had said previously there was. Secondly, he attributed a lot of significance to the fact that this gentleman, upon being asked in 2002 whether he had belonged to political organizations, indicated that he wasn't. This gentleman never said he was involved with political organizations. What he said was, his comments were being attributed to him as imputed political opinion by operatives of the Jordanian government security forces based upon what he was saying. Imputed political opinion is completely different than political opinion that one has by virtue of belonging to political organizations.
Now, I understand you quarrel with some of the findings that he's made, but isn't the standard that you have to make, I mean, you have to show there was a substantial constitutional question such that we should exercise jurisdiction to prevent a bizarre miscarriage of justice. What can you point to in this record that shows that there's a bizarre miscarriage of justice?
All right. With respect to the remand was made upon my motion for a specific purpose for adjustment. It is one thing to look to history from prior testimony. It's quite another to engage in what is clearly, when one reads the record, a very calculated effort to create inconsistencies. As a matter of fact, as the record shows, I posed a number of objections to the manner in which the judge was proceeding, which he, of course, pretty much cast aside very clearly, because it's his perception he can conduct the hearing in any way that he sees fit. Well, quite frankly, I believe that the facts of this case show clearly that he violated the requirement that he is to engage in and conduct a hearing that is impartial and provides a fair opportunity to the applicant to receive a fair consideration of what he is applying for. And also, quite frankly, I believe that what is a further evidence of that fact is that although the judge did not ever conclude that there was anything frivolous about his original adjustment application, he later on at the adjustment hearing used that as a, quote, consideration for worthiness of relief. The fact that he had pursued a, quote, frivolous application, although he acknowledged it really wasn't frivolous under the rules that characterized what a frivolous application was. He never said he fabricated any kind of statements. He mentioned inconsistencies. I submit that those inconsistencies, under the circumstances, more than 2 years later, a person who has paranoid schizophrenia, who has some limitations on addressing hostile environments, there was nothing very inconsistent about what he said. And quite frankly, I think it's also clear from the dialogue that the judge cut off any effort that he made to try to explain it. There was a portion of the dialogue where the respondent asked for the opportunity to clarify something and the judge wouldn't allow it. He would simply say, answer yes or no, answer yes or no. Well, quite frankly, I think that's conduct that's unbecoming an immigration judge. He's charged with the responsibility to conduct a hearing to allow a fair and impartial hearing. I think everything that happened in this hearing points very pointedly to the fact that this immigration judge knew what he was going to do before he did it, and he wanted to create a record that would allow him to, quote, exercise his discretion as he had already decided he would do it. Another comment that bears that out is he went so far as to require us to, he adjourned the final hearing for final decision to allow us to submit psychiatric statements from two treating psychiatrists, one from Wisconsin, one from Jordan, to show that he was a danger to society. Those statements clearly indicated that. After he received those statements, he concluded that he could not deny adjustment on the basis of mental defect or disease, but he did say that he found the, quote, psychiatric episodes, quote, to be troubling. Now, I don't know what qualifications he has to make a decision like that, but again, I think it very clearly demonstrates...
Why doesn't he have the authority to read over a psychiatric report and make that decision that it is troubling to him?
He didn't refer to the psychiatric reports. As a matter of fact, the psychiatric reports very, very clearly stated he wasn't a danger to himself or anyone else. The episode
well,
he talked...
What's wrong with it if the judge said it is troubling to me?
Well, troubling is one thing, but then he said... Let me put it in the context of the way he used it. He said, I will use this determination in coming to my conclusion about, quote, worthiness for the relief. Now, I'm not sure how he tied in the, quote, troubling aspects with worthiness for relief.
Did you ask him?
Did I ask him? I couldn't ask him because he was dictating his decision at the time, Your Honor.
Did you ask him after to explain anything that troubled him?
I didn't ask him after the decision, no, because quite frankly, I think it would have been an absolute exercise in futility to do so. So the answer is no, I didn't ask him. I didn't have the opportunity to ask him because he didn't use the expression until he was dictating his decision. But I guess what I'm saying is it's very clear from, this is really a factually unusual case, I think. I've never seen a case like this where a judge goes back to several years earlier, can't really come to a definitive basis for saying that this establishes you're not eligible for the relief, but says it's an exercise in determining the worthiness. And I think here it's clear he was just simply following his preordained agenda. And I guess that... My time is up here.
If you want to, the light goes on, and you still have 3 minutes for your rebuttal, but you're in your rebuttal time.
All right. I would choose then to wait.
All right.
Thank you.
Mr. Hogan?
Good morning. May it please the Court. John Hogan for the Attorney General. I think this case is really simple and straightforward. What we have here is the judge's discretionary decision to deny adjustment of status. The board affirmed without opinion that decision. Thus, this court can look right to the judge's decision. And when you look at that, we see it's discretionary. And as Your Honor pointed out in the beginning, 8 U.S.C. Section 1252 is a door-closing statute that does not allow this court to review that decision. So I think it really comes down to that simple basis. As Mr. Block said, it's a factually heavy case, but it's discretionary factors that are determined by the judge. And because of that, this court doesn't have jurisdiction to review that. Some of the arguments in the briefs were about the affirmance without opinion and whether there was jurisdiction to review that. But this court's already said, and it's a low decision, that if you have an immigration judge decision that you can review, you don't even get to that issue. And that's what we'd ask you to do here is simply look at the judge's decision, well thought out. Perhaps parties can differ. Obviously, that's why we're here today. But it's still discretionary, meaning no jurisdiction to review here.
I have a couple questions. The IJ seemed very troubled that Hamden didn't attend school after obtaining a student visa. But wasn't there evidence that he thought his uncle would pay and he never did?
Correct, Your Honor. And I think that's just it's a factor to be considered. The judge considered that, and along with other factors, used that to deny adjustment of status and discretion. What's clear is that Mr. Hamden was here for at least 4 years and hadn't gone to back to the University of Wisconsin any time, even though that's the reason he initially came here to do that. He eventually goes to a technical college for some time, and as he stated in his last hearing before the judge. He's working as a cashier and stuff. But if the bottom line is that Mr. Hanlon was here 4 years before he applied for asylum. So the judge was looking at factors as to why were you here, how long were you here, what were you doing. And when he considered all those, he denied adjustment of status in an exercise of discretion. It's unfortunate for Mr. Hanlon, of course. However, this court doesn't have jurisdiction to review that decision.
And one other question. You suggested in your brief that we should adopt a blanket rule that we can never review the decision to streamline, but haven't our cases recognized an exception to jurisdictional bars when substantial constitutional questions are raised?
True, Your Honor. I just don't think this case arises to that. The judge asked pointed questions. He brought up the issue about his prior asylum testimony after that was raised on direct examination. So I just don't think we come to that issue or to that conclusion today about some kind of constitutional violation. Pointed questions were asked to get to the bottom line of Mr. Hamden's adjustment application. He was the only witness to testify, so the only one that was trying to prove his case. His family members were not there that day, so I think the judge was well within his rights to ask those questions.
Any questions?
Thank you.
Thank you. You have 2.5 minutes, Mr. Block.
Thank you. The constitutional issue thing, I think, is present in this case. I believe that this gentleman has a constitutional right to a fair and impartial hearing. I don't think there's any objective reading of excerpts of the testimony in this case that would lead one to conclude that this was a fair and impartial hearing.
Isn't there a presumption that attaches here? We presume that the immigration judge was impartial, and you've got a heavy burden to overcome that.
And I think the record establishes that burden. I think it meets that burden. I don't think there's any question as to the fact that the immigration judge went about trying to provide the underpinnings for a pre-ordained opinion he was going to make. And for instance, the two things that he discusses as negatives in the positive-negative balancing, abusive immigration history. He came to the United States initially in 1984, went to school for a semester, went back to his country. What's abusive about that? He didn't overstay. He didn't stay beyond what he was going to do. He had had some problems. Psychologically, he went back home. He didn't come back again as a student until 1993. When the judge asked him about 1993 as a student, he explained that he didn't have the money to go after he got here because his uncle hadn't paid him. Non-resident tuition in Wisconsin, as several of your honors know, is a very heavy financial thing. He didn't have it, so he couldn't go.
And why didn't he go back to Georgia?
I beg your pardon?
Why didn't he go back to Georgia?
Well, he was receiving some additional psychiatric counseling. Plus, when he was in Jordan, he testified the atmosphere that he encountered there. He was taken into custody several times. He was beaten several times. That testimony in his initial asylum hearing, although the judge ruled it didn't rise to the level of persecution, the judge did not find that his testimony was not credible. Thank you, Your Honors. I submit that this case does provide the exception for the non-reviewability.
Thank you. And thank you, Counsel. We'll take the case under advisement.